Hey everybody, this is Mina 007. Welcome to an episode of Vassals of Kingsgrave's Agatha Christie Linear Reread. Today we're covering They Do It With Mirrors, which was originally published in November 1952. It's a Miss Marple mystery. The plot summary is as follows. While visiting her American school friend Ruth Van Rydock in London, Miss Marple learns that Ruth is seriously concerned for her sister Carrie Louise. She asks Miss Marple to visit Carrie Louise under false pretenses at her house, Stony Gates. Carrie Louise is by this time on her third husband, Mr. Lewis Sericold, and has converted her mansion into a reform school for wayward boys. Once again, this is a novel that is set in the fallout of World War II, and we are seeing the impact of social change, especially on big country houses like these, which are incredibly expensive to maintain, especially in an environment where it's increasingly hard to get good staff and where taxes are very high. Almost immediately, as Miss Marple goes to Stony Gates, she comments on the fact that there aren't as many porters at train stations these days, and all the different outfits people wear to dinner. So some are in black tie, some are dressed very formally, some are dressed very casually. So it feels like those social codes of how to dress for dinner in a country house have broken down. We get a little bit of war impact still in these novels. Here's a quotation from Gina. "It's the thugs I like best. I don't fancy the weirdos so much. Of course, Lewis and Dr. Maverick think they're all weird. I mean, they think it's repressed desires and disordered home life and their mothers getting it off with soldiers and all that. I don't really see it myself because some people have had awful home lives and yet have managed to turn out quite all right." So the idea that we're now living with the social impact of all those women who had affairs or indeed married GIs, but that we have the first impact of what that did maybe to the children who were in the family with daddy away at war. Then we have another quotation here very early in the novel, the first impression of Stony Gates. Quote, "They turned in through some imposing gates where a commissionaire was standing on duty in a military manner and drove up a drive flanked with rhododendrons. The drive was badly kept and the ground seemed neglected. Interpreting her companion's glance, Gina said, 'No gardeners during the war and since we haven't bothered, but it does look rather terrible.'" End quote. So yes, the idea that these great country houses are going to rack and ruin because there is no labour to maintain them, or perhaps even money. And here we have, again, speaking to that idea that Americans came and took all the women. Quote, "Inspector Curry smiled softly to himself. 'A GI pinched my best girl,' he said reminiscently. 'Naturally, I'm prejudiced. His manner doesn't help,'" end quote. That speaks to Gina's American husband. But yes, you can see a little bit of that friction from the home front between the English men and the Americans. And as with a lot of these post-war Marple novels, we have a lot of comments on class and class prejudice between working and middle-class people. Here we have a quotation. "Poor Ruth. She was frightfully upset over Gina's marriage, but I've told her again and again that I don't blame her in the least. Ruth doesn't realise, as I do, that the old barriers and class shibboleths are gone, or at any rate are going. Gina was doing her war work, and she met this young man. He was a Marine and had a very good war record, and a week later they were married. It was all far too quick, of course. No time to find out if they were really suited to each other, but that's the way things are nowadays. Young people belong to their generation." End quotation. And actually, I would argue that Agatha Christie here, in pointing out Gina, very rich Gina's marriage to a poor American soldier, is being quite sympathetic. The idea that she acknowledges that class barriers are breaking down, and she puts Ruth Van Rydock, who is Miss Marple's age, into a generation that just doesn't understand this. But I feel that Agatha is sort of on the side of the young here, which is really wonderful at the age of 62 when she's writing this. Here's another quotation speaking to class difference. "Now, don't upset yourself, ma'am. The old ones liked ma'am," he thought. "To them, police officers were definitely of the lower classes and should show respect to their betters." End quote. So this is the police officer investigating, playing on the fact that he thinks Carrie Louise will be rather class prejudiced, which actually I don't think she really is, but there we are. And then, just to show how modern Agatha Christie can be, is this the first mention of a prostitute in Agatha Christie? Quote, "Well, you see, I had rather hard time of it as a kid. The other boys jeered at me because I hadn't got a father, said I was a little bastard, which I was, of course. Mum was usually drunk and she had men coming in all the time. My father was a foreign seaman, I believe. The house was always filthy and it was a pretty fair hell. And then I got to thinking, supposing my dad had not been to some foreign sailor but someone important." End quote. Agatha Christie, not quite as twee and simplistic and old-fashioned as people sometimes think she is when they watch those terrible sepia-toned television adaptations. Okay, let's cover the events that were going on when readers received this book in their hands. The last novel, Mrs. McGinty's Dead, was published in March 52, a Poirot novel, so weren't they lucky to have a Poirot and a Marple in the same year? And this novel was published in November, so there's not much to get to. April 1952, we have the Bolivian Revolution. June 1952, Anne Frank's The Diary of a Young Girl is published in English language translation. And the United States Special Forces are created. July 1952, General Mohammed Naguib leads the Free Officers, formed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, the real power behind the coup, in the overthrow of King Farouk of Egypt. And Evita Peron dies. August 1952, reparation negotiations between West Germany and Israel end in Luxembourg. Germany will pay Israel 3 billion Deutschmarks. October 1952, martial law is declared in Kenya in the face of the Mau Mau uprising against British colonial rule. In November 1952, the United States successfully detonates the first hydrogen bomb, codenamed Mike, at Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands. General Dwight D. Eisenhower defeats Democratic Governor of Illinois Adlai Stevenson in the U.S. presidential election. So, this is a time of great post-colonial or certainly sort of revolutionary times, instability in those liminal areas between West and East. And it is also a time of Cold War tension, the detonation of the hydrogen bomb being just one example of that. And the fact that America chooses to elect, I guess, an ex-military commander speaks to the tensions of the time. Okay, so let's get into the story now. And it is a short one, actually. It's as short as Peril at Ten House, just 218 pages. So for context, a lot of these that I read in paperback form vary between sort of 250 to 350 pages. So this is very much on the short side. And, dear reader, it contains a map. We must take it seriously when Agatha Christie gives us a map of the house or a map of anything, because it's probably some kind of clue. Here are the characters that we meet. Miss Marple, our heroine, the old woman with detective skills, feminine intuition and a never-ending series of stories from St. Mary Mead that remind her or give her parallels to dodgy characters in the present. We have Ruth Van Rydock, an old school friend of Miss Marple. She's an American socialite. And there's a wonderful passage at the start of this book, which I cannot help feeling is a little bit Agatha Christie in Envy, where she describes how Ruth Van Rydock is dressed in the most exquisite clothes and has kept her figure and is now on her third husband and has not aged at all. And I think for a woman who was very beautiful in her youth and had many proposals, the contrast between Agatha then and at this point at age 62 must have been quite, well, maybe tragicomic. And it's kind of interesting that she points out the opposite. One of the adaptations of this novel stars Joan Collins in this role, which I think is perfect, perfect casting. And then the third person who made up their trio at school is Ruth's sister, Carrie Louise Sericold, who is someone who is portrayed as being rather simplistic, rather naive, rather innocent, whose innocence must be protected. So there's always lots of discussions about how information must be withheld from her. But it's fascinating to know that Miss Marple thinks she's maybe not quite as innocent as she seems and that she should be taken rather more seriously and not infantilized. Now, Carrie Louise has had rather a complex marital life, and I'm going to go through this and hopefully make it a little bit clearer for you, but I wouldn't blame you if you made notes as you read the novel on how everyone interacts with everyone else. So a very young, idealistic Carrie Louise married a man called Mr. Eric Gulbranson, who was much, much older than her, a rich philanthropist who already had three sons from his first marriage. The principal character of those is a man called Christian Gulbranson, who is on the board of the Gulbranson Family Trust and periodically visits the house for meetings of the board and doles out money to the worthies. He's probably about the same age as Carrie Louise herself. So Carrie Louise and Mr. Gulbranson had a daughter called Pippa that they adopted together. She married an Italian marquis and died in childbirth, leaving behind the daughter Gina that I've already referred to, who's half British or half American, I guess, half Italian. She spent World War II in the US with her Aunt Ruth, kind of to get out of danger, has been very spoiled by Carrie Louise and has married Walter. Walter is the American working class mechanic, and he's kind of pissed off that he's stuck in England. He wants to go back with his wife to America and start a new life there. So while Carrie Louise and Mr. Gulbranson adopted Pippa because they thought they couldn't have a child, she also fell pregnant with a daughter called Mildred. Now, while Pippa was very, very pretty and very, very spoiled, Mildred was unfortunately rather plain. She's been widowed a few years before the story begins. She doesn't have children, and she's the one who sort of brings the mood down. She bemoans the deterioration of the house, is very jealous of Pippa, and feels that she was always passed up in favour of her. Here's a quotation from the book. Even the tight line of her lips had an ascetic ecclesiastical flavour. She expressed Christian endurance and possibly Christian fortitude, but not, Curry thought, Christian charity, end quote. And I think this is quite meaningful because there's not much charity towards sort of pernickety, devout, so to say, Christians. I mean, Agatha Christie has short shrift for people who follow the letter of the law but have no charity or no love within them. I think she was quietly very, you know, solidly Anglican and had a faith, but it's funny how vicars and the self-important and pompous religious people always come a cropper in her novels. Okay, so that's the first marriage to Mr. Gulbranson, and it's really the Gulbranson Foundation that seeds a lot of money to Carrie Louise in the present day. She then marries Johnny Resterick, who basically is a set designer who wants to live a soft life with a rich wife. He had an affair, though, so he betrayed Carrie Louise, and it's all rather scandalous. He was potentially murdered by his new wife. And he's got two sons from the first marriage. They're not actually Carrie Louise's children, but she feels a sort of duty of care towards them. So they're both present at Stonygates. There's Stephen Resterick. He works in the theatre and helps the young wayward boys to stage plays there. And there's Alexis Resterick, who's Stephen's older brother. And both of them, even though she's married, have a bit of a thing for Gina. So not Carrie Louise's kids, but people to whom she feels she has a duty of care. And then finally, after marrying the rich Mr. Gulbranson and the cheating poor Johnny Resterick, Carrie Louise marries Louis Sericold, who was once an accountant and is now really quite sort of fanatical and enthusiastic about the charitable treatment of these wayward boys. And his basic thesis is that rather than putting people who've committed petty crimes in prison and making them into hardened criminals, we should look at rehabilitating them. And that's actually not a bad idea, right? But so he sort of transforms this manor house. He builds a kind of a barracks next door where he houses these boys, and he tries to give them psychiatric help and give them responsibility and give them a sense of purpose and reform them, basically. Also in the house, we have Juliet Beliver, called Jolly. She is Carrie Louise's secretary and companion. She seems to be rather bossy and ready to be running the show, and probably takes advantage of the fact that Carrie Louise is rather childlike and is innocent and sort of lets Jolly just do what she wants to do. We also have Edgar Lawson, who is one of the boys in that's been taken in, but he is given a position of authority, right? Because Louis Sericold kind of makes him his personal secretary. And so he's more often in the actual manor house rather than in the barracks where everyone else lives. So those are the characters. And what is the murder? Well, very soon after Miss Marple arrives at Stony Gates, Christian Gulbranson, so the guy who sits on the board of the trust, makes a very unexpected visit because he normally comes with very regular cadence to inspect the books. And he's made a special visit to come and see Carrie Louise. And he is found murdered in his room, and there's a typewriter at his desk, and whatever he was typing, that piece of paper has been taken. So that's what starts off, that's the first murder victim. But actually what Miss Marple is worried about is that someone is trying to poison Carrie Louise. And that is what Louis Sericold believes. He can see him sort of trying to make sure she's not drinking anything that she shouldn't. There's an air of real concern and worry over the house. From my perspective, this is actually a pretty sprightly read. I think I read it in one sitting. I liked the characters. I thought having the sort of the boys' home was quite an interesting twist to the tale of a country house murder. I think the plotting, particularly of the first murder, is very interesting. There are, as always in Agatha Christie, sometimes there are second or third murders. So there are other murders, and I don't think they're as well done. I think the book in its first half is better than the second half, which I think is a judgment that's shared by a lot of the reviewers. I think for me, this is second tier Christie. I would probably put it slightly above Mrs. McGinty's Dead, just because I think that I really like the setup. I love the characters. I think there's something that Agatha Christie does so well, which is observe human behaviour and human peccadilloes. And the idea that you have these two daughters, one adopted, one not. And because the parents are so worried about favouring the biological daughter, they almost overcompensate and love the adopted daughter. And that sets up layers of jealousy, I think is very credible and believable. So I love the kind of human aspects of this novel. But as with many of the 1950s novels, you can tell there's a little bit of decline from the truly great novels of the 30s and 40s. Does the novel hold up to a modern reader? Is it progressive or regressive? Well, there is a touch of homophobia in here, not as it typically occurs with Agatha Christie, with a deeply camp character. When Gina tells Miss Marple how she gets on with the delinquent inmates, quote, "It's the thugs I like best. I don't fancy the queers so much." Now, interestingly, this line was not in the new edition that I purchased, but it is in older editions. So I guess at some point that was taken out. So you may or may not see that line. When she's asked by Inspector Curry who she thinks might have committed the murder, she, quote, "One of the queers did it, I should think," from Gina. So, goodness, when was that taken out? I'm glad it was. Am I glad it was? I sometimes feel these books should be just given to us as written to allow us to understand what was acceptable in the time and how things change and how we learn. Apparently, the original copy of the book also regrettably featured one use of the N-word in reference of the idiomatic phrase, the woodpile phrase, that wasn't in my edition again, so that's been taken out. And yet, so it's not acceptable in modern editions to use the Q word or to use the N word, but it is still okay to have anti-Italian racism in the context of Gina's character. Maybe they think that's too sort of embedded in the story to take it out, but I find it fascinating what people feel is okay and not okay in modern literature. This is Gina. Quote, "I hate it. I think it's horrible. Why do you think I'm so upset? Because I'm very half Italian." Very possibly. At least perhaps it explains why you don't mind showing what you feel, end quote. And then Mildred, quote, "Oh, San Severiano. You know what Italians are. Nothing matters to them but money. He married Pippa for her money, of course. Dear me, I always understood he was very devoted to her and was quite inconsolable at her death. He pretended to be, no doubt. Why mother ever countenanced her marrying a foreigner, I can't imagine. Just the usual American pleasure in a title, I suppose." End quote. Then finally, quote, "Not a bit of it. Gina would say anything. The Italians are never truthful, and she's a Roman Catholic, of course." End quote. So the whole thing is really unpleasant. And it just speaks to, I think, I don't know, like what, there's a PhD to be written, isn't there, about what's acceptable to readers at certain times. A decision has been made that the N-word isn't, but that this kind of stuff is. I find it completely fascinating. And then, as with some of the Agatha Christie novels that deal with adoption and heredity, there is something weird going on around recidivism. And it's quite unpleasant. It's quite disturbing. You get that a little bit in Mrs. McGinty's Dead as well. Here's a very interesting passage. "Whilst here we are so very fond of failures," said Miss Marple. Louis Sericold looked at her sharply and suspiciously. She flushed a little and murmured rather incoherently, "I think sometimes, you know, one can overdo things the other way. I mean, the young people with a good heredity and brought up wisely in a good home and with grit and pluck and the ability to get on in life, well, they are really, when one comes down to it, the sort of people a country needs." Lewis frowned, and Miss Marple hurried on, getting pinker and pinker and more incoherent. "Not that I don't appreciate, I do indeed, you and Carrie Louise, a really noble work, real compassion. And one should have compassion, because after all it's what people are that counts, good and bad luck, and much more expected and rightly of the lucky ones. But I do think sometimes one's sense of proportion. Oh, I don't mean you, Mr. Sericold. Really, I don't know what I mean. But the English are rather odd that way. Even in war, so much prouder of their defeats and their retreats than of their victories. Foreigners never can understand why we're so proud of Dunkirk. It's the sort of thing they'd prefer not to mention themselves. But we always seem to be most embarrassed by a victory and treat it as though it weren't quite nice to boast about it." End quote. I don't know, it's just a really fascinating bit of Miss Marple expressing how she feels. And it's very patriotic. It's very But it is very much about heredity, isn't it? Good young people brought up in good homes. And it sort of implies that really what they're doing here with a charity to reform people who've had bad chances in life. And I don't know. It's very weird, strange. It doesn't come up again, but I do find it a little bit problematic. Anyway, let's get into the adaptations. There are four, amazingly. We have the 1964 film Murder Ahoy with Miss Marple, played by Margaret Rutherford. This is the second one I've seen in as many days, and I have to say, I really did enjoy it too. But as with all these Margaret Rutherfords, it's only very loosely based on the book. So Miss Marple wears a naval costume. She sits on the board of a school for delinquents that's actually set on board a retired battleship. So there's lots of naval jokes, naval characters. They Do It With Mirrors is not credited as the film's inspiration. It's very loose, but it is kind of there. So it's just funny, though, because Miss Marple here, although an old lady, is someone who can do experiments Sherlock Holmes style. And in a climactic final scene, we discover that she can fence. So it really is very good fun. The second adaptation is from 1985. It's a television film called Murder with Mirrors. It stars Sir John Mills as Lewis Sericold, Bette Davis as Carrie Louise, a very old, very thin Betty Davis, and Tim Roth as Edgar Lawson, and the wonderful Helen Hayes as Miss Marple. This was actually her last role, and Rumpole of the Bailey as the cop. It's largely faithful to the book. You can find it in full on YouTube, actually, and I thought this was a delightful adaptation. Really holds up and was a great pleasure to watch. The third adaptation comes in 1991, and it's part of the BBC series Miss Marple with Joan Hickson. Jean Simmons here plays Carrie Louise, Joss Ackland as Lewis Sericold, and Faith Brooke as Ruth Van Rydock. It's a very faithful rendition of the novel. I do find all of these ones a little bit dry, and I would say if you want something faithful with that old-fashioned feel, maybe check out the 1985 Murder with Mirrors instead. And then the fourth and final adaptation so far was one done in 2010 for the fourth season of the ITV Agatha Christie's Marple with Julia McKenzie as Miss Marple, who I think is rather wonderful. This is the one that has Joan Collins as Ruth Van Rydock, Penelope Wilton as Carrie Louise, so both of them are doing American accents, and Brian Cox. So all of you Succession fans, you've got Brian Cox as Lewis Sericold. It has a couple of changes to the book, but actually I think, again, this works very well. I did like this version. And the Miss Marples of this ITV series often take great liberties and fall apart because of them. But I think here, where it takes liberties, they sort of work. If you watch it on its own terms, I think it's actually great fun. But I think of these four, I would probably pick the Helen Hayes one first because it's more accurate and it just is a pleasure to watch. Okay, folks, that is it for the spoiler-free part of the discussion. Join us next time for episode 44, where we'll talk about After the Funeral, aka Funerals the Fatal, another Hercule Poirot novel. But if you want to hear the solution to this book and some of the clues, stay for the after the end credits music for that explanation. So here are some of the clues. Lewis Sericold is also on the board of the Gulbranson Trust, and he had a background as an accountant. Edgar Lawson, his self-appointed secretary and son, is far too theatrical. He's playing a part of being mentally unbalanced. Both are involved in the misdirect, so the big argument that they supposedly have in the attempted shooting behind locked closed doors. So instead of asking who is in the hall when Christine Gulbranson is killed, one should ask who is in the library. And when one asks who is in the library, you realise it's Lewis and Edgar, and therefore they must be responsible for the murder. And I think this is the flaw of the novel, because actually I think it's quite easy to figure out who committed that first murder. The complexity of the motive for the murder, I think, does take a bit further to figure out, because what I thought was that Lewis Sericold had killed Gulbranson because he'd figured out that Lewis was taking money out of the trust to fund his philanthropy, which is true. But actually, it's much more involved in that Lewis Sericold is placing boys who have supposedly been reformed into accountancy jobs and swindling money from others to fund this supposed utopia. So the argument in the library and the shots fired are a misdirect, but also the idea that Carrie Louise might be subject to poisoning is a misdirect. And one of the keys to solving the murder is to realise that Carrie Louise is not such an innocent. She actually is very aware of what's going out around her. And as Miss Marple says, if you take her at her word, like she doesn't think she's being poisoned, then you look at the murder in a whole new manner and you realise that Christine Gulbranson truly is the intended victim. And therefore, it's something about the trust and the motive is money. Okay, well, I hope that was a good, simple explanation for you. As I say, I think this was a rather simple little crime to solve in the end, but quite an enjoyable one to read, at least at first. Do join us next time for After the Funeral. In the meantime, please do leave a comment on the YouTube channel or join us on the Vassals of Kingsgrave Discord server. We'd love to hear your comments. Thank you for listening. Thank you.